You're listening to Rendezvous with a Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rendezvous with a Writer, where readers and writers meet, and story is everything. We're your hosts tonight, Jim and Bobby Bell. You've just been listening to the Hot Texas Band doing their rendition of Hot Texas.
And we're so glad you're joining us. Right?
Yes, we
are. This is show number 97. We are now into the beginning part of our third year of broadcasting. We're so delighted that you have decided to join us. Whether you are along for the ride live tonight or you're catching this on demand beginning later tonight, we're just delighted to have you with us.
We are.
And who's joining us tonight?
Special guest, Howard Kaplan.
And there he is.
And we're getting his book, The Syrian Sunset.
I'm here.
We've got a thriller.
Oh, my goodness.
We've got a history novel. Mm-hmm. We got some crazy things going on in the world that people need to know about, and this book will help.
Yes, we all need to know what's happening in this book and how it is the roots of some of what's happening today. Howard, welcome. Where are you joining us from?
I'm in Los Angeles. You know, I love the new world. We used to have to do interviews, get on a plane, and go somewhere, and now we just walk across the house to the office.
That's right.
Yeah.
And it's just like we were all in together live in that studio, LA Talk Radio studio.
Yeah, other than it looks like my office with my books behind it.
Yeah. Well, we are really delighted to have you with us. And this book captivated both of us. I'm going to hold it up again. We're talking tonight about The Syrian Sunset. And oh my goodness, what a story. So Howard, Jim's going to introduce you with a little bit of bio. We're going to learn a little bit more about you, and then we're going to talk about the book. So Jim, take it away.
All right. Howard Kaplan, a native of Los Angeles, has lived in Israel and traveled extensively through Lebanon, Syria, and Egypt. At the age of 21, he was sent on a mission into the Soviet Union to smuggle a dissident's manuscript on microfilm in London, to London. His first trip was a success. On his second trip, he transferred the manuscript to the Dutch ambassador inside his Moscow embassy. A week later, Ukraine, and interrogated for 2 days there and then 2 days in Moscow before being expelled from Russia. The KGB had picked him up for meeting dissidents and did not know about the manuscript transfer.
Oh, my gosh.
Howard holds a BA in Middle East History from UC Berkeley and a MA in Philosophy of Education from UCLA. He is the author of 5 novels. His book, Damascus Cover, is now a major motion picture starring Jonathan Myers, Sir John Hurt, and Olivia Thirlby. Tonight, we'll be talking in depth about the most recently published title, The Syrian Sunset.
Syrian Sunset.
All right.
Oh, my goodness. Howard, we want to know more about what happened when you were held by the KGB. And as a young man, were you scared? Did you figure, oh, this
will... I'll tell you how it worked. In those days, it was under the Soviets. And you'd go in through Intourist into the Soviet Union. And it would be a tour for a prescribed number of days. So I was on a 14-day tour, and I was arrested on the 10th day. So to answer your question, I felt they had 4 days to play with me. And if I could manage to talk my way out of it, which my ex-wife said I was very good at, that they would likely expel me on my scheduled flight. So for the 4 days, I wasn't terribly terrified. It was a gentler time. I would not go into the Soviet Union today, to Russia today, to do these kinds of things. But it was an era more of detente where they were looking for better relations. So they ended up expelling me on my scheduled flight. They actually wanted to follow me in London to see who had sent me.
So, excuse me, to prepare you for these couple of missions, did you have to learn some spycraft?
Well, I got picked up originally in Jerusalem. I was doing my junior abroad, and they were sort of recruiting American students who would drop into Moscow on their way home, kind of on the way. So I learned a lot of rudimentary spycraft and greatly how to think. Because I was taught by a handler in London. He said, I can't prepare you for everything, but I can prepare you how to think. For example, they told me, you're going to be, if you're picked up, they're going to threaten you with 15 years in prison. So I got picked up and they threatened me with 10 years imprisonment. So I felt slighted. I didn't get the full threat.
Yeah.
The most interesting thing I was taught, and I brought this book, The Hobbit, up to show you. In a second, I'll explain why. I didn't have the elephantine memory that, you know, maybe a trained espionage agent does. So when I was told information by the dissidents, I wanted to write it down. So they taught me to take a fountain pen, fill it with milk, which even in the limits of the Soviet Union, they had, and write in the pages in milk. And then it evaporates and you can't see it. Then what happens is, I can pull out some of these pages. You go back to London or wherever you're going and you iron the page with a normal household iron.
Amazing.
The milk burns and becomes legible.
Oh my gosh.
See the kind of brown from burning the iron, you know, the page. Mm-hmm. And then I wrote over it. When I could see the milk, I went in and here's another page. I got a lot of them. You know, I've saved the book all these years.
Of course.
But I can't tell you exactly what's in it. I haven't read it in a while.
Howard, that's fascinating.
So, you know, it was very simple and very effective.
What actually were you taking in and out?
To take in, the first time I didn't take in anything because they wanted me, to take out a roll of microfilm. I didn't want to be tagged as someone who brought in material for dissidents. And if you recall, some of your older viewers will certainly remember, in the pre-digital age, we had Kodak film slide in little yellow boxes in little yellow canisters. So we inserted in a Moscow artist studio the microfilm, which was not a micro dot, it was, you know, a long roll of film, into the yellow canister, and then closed the canister, which actually was hard to do because they were not meant to open, and then glued the box back together to make it look like it was new. And I had a camera bag, and let's say maybe 15 rolls of film, and maybe 8 or 9 of them, 10 were exposed that I shot tourist pictures, which they could have taken, used, you know, picked up. And the other 5 were new, as if, well, I didn't take that many pictures. And so this box was closed. And I came right through. I went to Russia twice. On the first trip, I came right through customs. I was not arrested on this trip. He just made passport control, customs, everything in Moscow. And back out to London with the microfilm with no problem. It was a novel, a political novel that was, you know, banned. They couldn't get it published inside Russia. And I brought it out for them because I was a little crazy. I would do anything that time.
Now, who was interrogating you at the time?
In Kharkov, they said they were KGB agents.
Okay.
In Moscow, it was very interesting. 2 guys accompanied me on the plane, the internal flight. And those days, remember, there weren't jetways. We walked down onto the tarmac. Mm-hmm. And waiting for me on the tarmac were 2 30-something gentlemen. One spoke perfect American English, perfect. You wouldn't have known he was not an American. Mm. And the other perfect British English. And they told me they were tour guides.
Did they have a sign with your name?
I think they kind of knew who they were meeting, you know, and they took me to this was interesting. They took me to a hotel, not in Moscow, but by the airport. It was a small and interrogated me in an office there. I was never hit or tortured or any of those kind of things. And they didn't have a restaurant in this small hotel. So every meal, they walked me into the airport, through passport, through customs, into the departure lounge, and I could get whatever I wanted to eat. And then they walked me back.
Oh,
I understood this to mean, if you behave, we're going to one time let you go. And they did do that. And on the final time they let me go, one of them said to me, everybody's treated you well here, correct? I said, yes. They said, we don't want any press conferences or anything to write about it, or we can find you anywhere in the world. And I remember this literally, he said, and next time we won't be so humanitarian. So I thought, oh, good, I can write about it. I may not be the smartest guy in the world, but I
Oh, my goodness. What a story. So tell us a little bit about your writing career, Howard. When did you start writing?
I started, my father was very disappointed that I wouldn't be a lawyer. They were used to the disappointment that I didn't like blood, so I couldn't be a doctor. And I was doing actually a PhD in education at UCLA. I thought I would go into community work. And at that time, a lot of teachers were in the program, so the classes didn't start till 4 p.m. I went from 4 till 10, so teachers could come after school and do their graduate work. And I'm a morning person, so I would get up and start writing this novel. And it was the Damascus cover. And I spent a year and a half writing it. I can't remember. And not so easily, but eventually I got a major agent, Norman Mailer and Arthur C. Clarke's agent. I met Frank Herbert in the offices one day. Because they were selling Dune. Or they had sold Dune. He was there. And once they sent it out, I sold it in a week to Dutton, which was a major publisher. They wanted a lot of rewrites, which I was happy to do because their ideas were better. And my first novel was published when I was in my late 20s. And that's the Damascus cover. I brought it. This is the original hardcover.
Very cool.
Tiny a little bit because it has a film on it. But this is I can't take it off. This is the original hardcover edition.
Yes.
It's supposed to be found on Amazon, you know, in some limited supply. Usually they're not very good. 40 years later, literally, I'm not so good at getting this straight.
No, you're perfect.
The film was made. And I really like both these covers. And you see Jonathan Rhys-Meyers at the top and Sir John Hurt at the bottom. Mm-hmm. He reprised his role that he'd done in Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy with Gary Oldman. And he was the head of the Israeli Secret Service. So this is my first book. It landed on the Los Angeles Times bestseller list. I did a big event, I was invited to a big event. I was the little guy at the big event at the Beverly Hilton Hotel. And sitting next to me was Clive Cussler.
Oh, my goodness.
He was a very famous thriller writer. And he was the nicest guy in the world. He read my early books. He gave me blurbs. And he used to write me handwritten letters. You know, he was kind of an old school guy.
Yeah.
Golden, Colorado, yeah. Which I still have. Mm. He passed not so long ago.
Mm-hmm.
He seems still to be writing books, even though he's passed. We've
seen like John Clancy.
Ghostwriting for sure.
Works, you know, usually with their son or cousin or somebody's name on it also.
Yeah.
But he was fabulous. He was a complete sweetheart. So I had a very auspicious start. I can't say that everything went as easy after that as I thought it would. You know, there were times I couldn't get published, times where it was harder to get published. But I'm still here. You know, The Syrian Sunset, people think, is my best book, has the best characters, and is the most important in a lot of ways. And in between, mm-hmm. I wrote three, I can show you two really briefly. I wrote a trilogy of novels of the Israeli-Palestinian mm-hmm. conflict, mm-hmm. trying for reconciliation between the sides, because I'd studied Islam at Berkeley. The first was Bullets of Palestine. The second is To Destroy Jerusalem, which is the heftiest of these three. And the last is The Spy's Gamble, which is a novel, pseudonymous novel about Netanyahu. And it's not very flattering. He's he's been a divisive and destructive force for everybody.
Are there any characters that kind of carry through all of the books?
Yes, there's Shaham, who is the main character, or one of the two main characters in The Syrian Sunset, is in all three of these books. So I've gotten to know him very well. Mm-hmm. He's patterned after a friend of mine who's an educator in Jerusalem, who's a kind of larger-than-life, gregarious sweetheart. Mm-hmm. And I was just, there's a screenplay being written of The Syrian Sunset, and I was just working on it and correcting some of the Shy scenes. For example, the screenwriter says, Shy's with a CIA agent, and he says, let's get lubricated, meaning drunk. Well, Shy doesn't drink. And if he drinks, he, you know.
He can't drink very much.
Yeah, he can't.
And he wouldn't know the difference between fine champagne and the champagne that's poured for the dog, which is one of the scenes in the book. So he would never say, let's get lubricated. So right. I just fixed it. I don't remember what I did, but it's not hard to fix. You know, it's just not in his inherent character. But the screenwriter hasn't read the other three books. He's done his best with the material he had.
I know you have a question.
You know, well, you and I were talking earlier about Lilia. And Afra. They meet for the first time, and he allows them a little time. He says, why don't you get acquainted? And Afra says, well, yeah, let's go have some fun and get away from the fat guy.
Yeah. He's, in fact, I'm just talking to the screenwriter now, because the version of the draft of the screenplay is a little bit dark. Part of the things that people liked about The Syrian Sunset is that even though it's about historically accurate about the Syrian civil war, and you know, there's some difficult scenes in it, it's also very funny and humorous. So the screenwriter has left out some of the humor. So because he's trying to get the story down.
Right.
So I cut out some of the machinations and said, let's put some of the humor back, because that's what audiences like. So there's a scene with them swimming with Shy Russian swimming, and it's not in the film. And I really liked it. And I, because it's not on topic for the plot, but I want them to put it back, at least put it in briefly. So these other women, these two women who are very similar, who switch places that you mentioned, they're patterned after an old girlfriend of mine from about 15 years ago. It seems like all my novels seem to have the last girlfriend in them in some way.
Do the girlfriends know this?
Oh, yeah. Do they?
Well, you know, they don't, usually when the relationship's over, and often they're the ones ending it, who knows? They don't seem to be eager to read the books. So I don't hear from them as to, and besides, I, as a matter of decency, I disguise everything completely. I mean, this is an American girl from the Midwest. So she's now a Syrian. They're now, these two young women are Syrians. But some of the personal habits, you know, that usually real life is more interesting than things you can make up. So the things I experience, you know, I kind of fold in whenever I can.
We are going to take a very short step away for just a moment to show and tell our audience where your books are available, one of the places your books are available, as well as all of the books of our featured guest on Rendezvous with a Writer. And that is our Out West Shop bookshop page from bookshop.org. And by the way, tomorrow, August 9th, 2024, in case you're listening to this a year from now, is the annual National Book Lovers Day. A great time to add a book or two to your must-read list. And this book should be on that list. When we come back, we're going to talk in-depth more with Howard about this terrific book, The Syrian Sunset. So don't go away. We'll be right back. Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shop's Bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com. Find books and CDs on the menu. Choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer. Special guest Howard Kaplan. And we're going to be talking about the Syrian Sunset, which has the backdrop of the Syrian Civil War. Howard, could you cover that for just a couple of minutes about what the war was about?
Yes, it was part of the Arab Spring. And the way some of my novels work, and particularly this one, it's historical, in that virtually all the events in the book are true, and they are as they happened. But the characters are entirely fictional, and they're not based on real people other than friends and people I've known. And the book opens with a scene where the Arab Spring, the Arab Awakening against dictators had begun in North Africa and Tunisia in 2011. And in Syria, in a city called Dara in the south, a bunch of schoolboys decided to get up in the middle of the night. They had red spray paint, and they sprayed on their school slogans against the president, Bashar al-Assad. They thought they'd be safe because nobody saw them. But this is a society, the way Russia used to be, where people inform on each other for advantages. And all the kids were arrested. They were like 15 and younger. And other kids from the school who worked there. And they were all tortured. And again, in some of the research, I read something that was very interesting. I couldn't have quite made this up myself. The secret police took the boys to a separate town, some, you know, 10 miles, 20 miles away. And the fathers came in to beg for their release because it's still a patriarchal society. And the mothers weren't allowed. And the secret police told the fathers, you'll never see your children again, but please bring your wives into the office. The secret police will impregnate them for you, and you can have more children. So I thought this was such a evil detail that I included it briefly, although I didn't show the scene. I just mentioned it the way
you mentioned it
here. So that's really how it started. That I wanted to retrace, and particularly maybe the most important thing is, if you recall historically, Obama drew a red line. You know, he came out in a speech and he said, there's a red line, and the red line means if Assad uses sarin, the chemical weapon, this will be crossing what we can tolerate. And we're not going to stand for it. About a year later, exactly, and I do this in the novel, I show this scene, I do show at length, while the UN inspection team, in actuality, was in the Sheraton Hotel in downtown Damascus, at night, they shot missiles into eastern Damascus, an area called Ghouta, where the rebel stronghold, the Free Syrian Army, was. And the sarin, I had to work on this with the screenwriter too, because in his first draft, he had all these huge explosions. He likes a lot of action. But sarin doesn't explode that way. It hits the ground in a dull thud, and then two parts connect, and the gas comes out. And the gas Sarin gas was originally developed during World War I for trench warfare. So it hugs the trench. So it spreads out, and actually your best defense against it is if you're in a building is to try to go to the roof, depending on how high the building is. So Assad killed about 1,000 people in this attack in 2013, and then became a whole set of machinations that exist in the novel. And I was very fortunate in this wonderful internet age, you can find things. And I found from the Atlantic, Ben Rhodes, who was a member of the, brain trust for Obama, wrote an article in the Atlantic about a meeting in great detail in the sit room in Washington between Obama, Rhodes was there, James Clapper from the CIA, a bunch of generals. It was a very lengthy article. You could find it, I'm sure, if I could find it. And I just stole from it mercilessly. Sure. Although my main character, McInerney, who's an American spy and who plays basketball with Obama, all that's made up. So I put McInerney in the room with all these actual characters. And sometimes people ask me this. I was thinking about this afternoon. I've thought about it a long time. I think when I was McInerney exists in Bolts of Palestine, one of the early, he's kind of a mentee. He's a younger agent then for Shy. Now they're more equal because McInerney's risen. But I always thought in case anybody tries to steal a manuscript or steal an idea, I would seed my books with the names of friends of mine. So McInerney, which a lot of people can't pronounce, which I'm very used to, comes from my friend Tom McInerney, who's an orthopedic surgeon in Albuquerque, where you are. He was in love with him for a long time. And Margaret Ito, who is the she was starting to be a nun, but my old Catholic girlfriend said, no, it's not credible that she would do these things. And she became a foreign aid worker. She's named for an actress friend of mine, Letitia Ito, who lives in Paris, who's French and Lebanese. And if people know the show Fauda, the TV series, which was very successful, she plays Shirin in that show. So her name's in there too. I think those are the only two I have. But I dare anybody to say they wrote the book.
Well, Margaret's a very interesting character.
An interesting character. She sure is.
Yeah. Yeah. She actually didn't make it into the film.
Really?
The screenwriter asked me if he could cut her out. Ooh. I like her a whole lot.
Yes.
The problem is, you got a book with a lot of pages.
Yeah.
And the film's got to be 2 hours.
Yeah.
And she's not a central character to the plot. She's a central character to the character, the main character. And we reluctantly decided to eliminate her. Mm-hmm. Which is why the book's always better than the movie.
Exactly. Why you read the book.
She is. It's interesting to see because that's a love interest of one of them. Right. Basically the bad guy, So it's,
And that was kind of a balancing act. I made the main character Fuad, someone who had done bad things, but who had a really good heart and did some wonderful things.
Mm-hmm.
So people ask me, did he do bad things because he really wanted to cover up that he was a good guy? And I said, no, that seemed less interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
He did bad things because he wanted to rise. He wanted advancement in the, Syrian regime. He becomes head of military intelligence. But when he gains this power, he works with foreign agents, foreign nationals, foreign spies, in favor of the Syrian people. And he has a very close relationship with his son, which I thought also would make him sympathetic. And that was easy for me because I have a son who's 30. And it seems like you're in Albuquerque. We're back to Albuquerque. So some of the scenes between the father and son in the book are things that actually happened between my son and I. For example, we were hiking somewhere in Albuquerque with McInerney's. I don't remember where. They might. And my son is searching the ground, and he's about 7 years old now, then, so probably around 2000. He says to me, Dad, I found a great discovery for you, a rattlesnake hole. And he starts poking around. So I put that right in the Syrian Sunset. It just seemed father and sonish for me.
Yeah. Can I want to ask about a couple characters that really just came out. Yeah. They really aren't part of the book. But one of them is this lady, Judy Carr. Could you just very briefly say who she is?
Yes, that's an interesting story because part of the background of particularly the Damascus cover, but and also the Syrian Sunset is that in 1948, when Israel was established, there were 75,000 Jews in Syria. And they were used as political pawns throughout the decades, sometimes let out, sometimes not let out. And by the time the 1970s arrived, when I wrote the Damascus cover, there were 5,000 Syrian Jews left in Damascus. And part of the plot of the Damascus cover, the subplot, it's not the main plot, is to get a group of children out. People who know this world know about Judy Carr Rubin. It's not generally known, but it's researchable. So I have her have gotten Afra out of Syria when she was a child. Mm. She's the Israeli agent who goes back into Syria for the plot of this novel. And who she was a lone woman, not connected to government, not connected to anybody, who decided she wanted to get as many of these 5,000 Jews out as she could. And she started raising money and bribing Syrian officials on her own without any support of anything. And she succeeded in getting hundreds of people out, others smuggled out because some that she bought out were able to give them information to set up smuggling links into Turkey. And I'm not sure if she's still alive today. I think she is. But she's not well known. She never sought notoriety. But again, you can find it's Judy Carr Rubin is the last name, right?
Rubin.
Yeah. And
She's still alive.
Yeah. This is the way I try to bring the history and the fiction together because I have some scenes with how Afra feels about being bought out from Syria. Yeah. And now, after many years, she's now an Israeli military person. She's asked to go back in on this mission. She's not a spy, but for a variety of reasons that I hope seem credible, she decided to do it.
Mm-hmm. We're going to step away one more time very quickly. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about some of the other characters. So don't go away. We are delighted to have Blue Cottage Agency along for the ride with us as one of our sponsors. And take a listen to this. If you're a writer, find out what they can do for you. Rendezvous with a Writer is sponsored by Blue Cottage Agency and Clicks by Madison. Your author publicity and book marketing team. Experienced, trusted, effective. Contact them today at bluecottageagency.com.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with the Writer with special guest Howard Kaplan. We're talking about this Syrian Sunset. We want to talk about some characters, right?
Yeah, and we've already touched on it.
Well, yes, we've already talked a few.
On our list, but we want to talk about a couple more.
Okay.
Who do you want to talk about? Who do you want to? Oh, do you want to ask him our fun character question first?
Yeah. Howard, I know you got control of these folks, but do they ever surprise you?
Oh, all the time. I mean, it's kind of fun. That's a sort of fun part of writing. I used to teach writing at UCLA Extension for a long time.
Okay.
And I used to suggest to people that before they start, they know the beginning and the end. And then where the characters meander during the story is maybe sometimes up to them. So things develop. You write A and then you write E later in the book. And then you say, oh, you can do this. I had, for example, when I wrote the Damascus cover, I created an additional character about three quarters of the way through because I needed two characters to have a conversation. It didn't seem, he didn't seem to be terribly important. He just was, you know, the guy couldn't talk to himself. He had to talk to somebody. I don't remember, it was so many years ago now, but very briefly thereafter, a few days, whatever it was, I said, oh my God, I could create a twist at the end of the novel using this character that I never conceived of. And one of the hallmarks of the Damascus cover was it has this unexpected twist at the end, and virtually nobody figures it out. Nobody sees it coming. You know how often you see a twist, you say, oh yeah, I knew that was going to happen. Nobody sees this one. Maybe because I didn't see it.
Yeah.
So, you know, it had full authenticity.
Well, you mentioned already a little bit about Fuad and his son. I may not be saying the names correctly, you know, so you can say them correct so all of our listeners and watchers get it right. And yes, his son. And it's not really a spoiler alert because we learn it pretty quickly in the book. But I was curious. The son is adopted, and it's a very important part of the story. But I was curious if you decided on that, like right from the beginning, how did that come about?
It was actually my first. I sat around doing notes for the book for a couple of months, and it was the only scene I got. I had a lot of blank pages for a long time. I had this initial idea. I wanted to show a real massacre that Bashar's father, Hafez al-Assad, had perpetrated in the city of Hama. This was pre-internet days, I think in 81, the massacre. And it was unknown. They hid it because there was no internet. There were no journalists there, and they were able to hide it, though it turns out people took pictures, which later came out once the internet was alive. So I had this idea that I could have Fuad somehow be somewhat responsible for some of the cover-up for the massacre. I didn't want him to be a mass murderer, but still something that made him look unsavory. Yet he has a plan, a long-term plan, and he wants to adopt a boy that he then later, I don't want to say too much about it, with the idea that he will somewhat use his son politically much later on. Though the love between them is entirely genuine, I said very easy for me to write because, you know, I have a son, it's my only child, and, you know, we remain close. I asked him today what shirt I should wear, so he decided on this one, so, you know.
Very good.
Well, that's the magic text thing I do. I call him, he doesn't answer, but if I text him, I get a response. So, I felt that maybe this whole idea was not believable. Scott Meredith was my first agent, you know, who handled, I said, Norman Mailer, Arthur C. Clarke, Jessica Mitford, Frank Herbert, all these people. He wrote a book called Writing to Sell, which is actually very useful for new writers. And what he said was, fiction has to be more believable than real life. Because in reality, the kookiest things in the world happen in real life. And he said he had all these novels he couldn't sell where people he would say it's not believable. The people would say this really happened. He said, I don't care. Yeah. It really happened. I care if it's inherently believable. So I had difficulty with this notion when people find it believable that someone would adopt a baby with the idea of grooming him in a certain way, let's say towards an end. It's very early on. So that he would work in the Syrian chemical weapons facility as a check against the regime. And I thought, this is dumb. Nobody's going to believe it. I was sort of stymied for 3 months. This is the whole thing I had. And it turns out everybody believes it. They say it's one of the best things in the book. It's really credible. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you just never know exactly how people are going to react. But I was self-conscious about it. I thought, like, who would do that? But again, people do things in life.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's very interesting. A lot of times fathers, you know, mothers, of course, maybe with sons or daughters, but you gave them a chemistry set, see? And a lot of times, you know, a kid learns to play golf, his father gave him a golf club.
Right.
At a very young age. And what am I going to do with this kind of thing?
My son wouldn't know what a chemistry set was. He would know manga and Pokemon and important things like that. We're kind of non-scientists in this house. But he has the idea that he wants to get him into the burgeoning, the new chemical weapons facilities in Syria. So at a young age, seven, I used to teach my son Martin Buber's I and Thou, which is about communication at seven. You know, he got a lot of it. When he was in college, he got more of it. He took the book and reread it. I remember picking it up and going back to Ohio and giving it to his girlfriend to read. But Fawad buys Qasim a chemistry set at age seven. And he even chooses the father that he adopts him from in order to have this kind of scientific genes so that he would be ultimately become a scientist. And the kid takes to it, you know, but maybe I would have liked given it to my son because the kid, Qasim likes blowing up things. So maybe any boy at seven likes blowing up things. So this was something to do.
I think it's also interesting in that relationship when he's choosing, when he's at the orphanage and he's choosing the son, that he would also like a son that perhaps has also inherited courage. And
I think genes are very powerful.
Yeah.
You know, my parents were Holocaust survivors. My mother was in Auschwitz, and they were not easy. I overcame a lot by choosing mentors when I was both 20 and 23. They became, one was a famous novelist, Michael Blankford, who wrote The Caine Mutiny. One was Arthur Hertzberg, who was the world's authority on Zionism. They both kind of took me in, and I think I needed them. I'm not quite sure what they saw in me, but I was open, always listening. A lot of people at in their early 20s know everything. I knew nothing, so I was kind of like fun. So I kind of escaped a lot of this family upbringing, but I still had those genetics. My father's a very smart guy. He just was dark because he lost his whole family in Poland. Mm-hmm. But he was a very successful businessman, and he could do a lot of things.
As a reader, your prose is so very engaging. And if you're a reader who's familiar with the area that Howard writes about, you will feel, I'm sure, this is familiar landscape. For me, an unfamiliar landscape. But Howard, your writing and the way that you describe from flowers on a mountainside to various places and marketplaces and all that you where you take us, I felt very comfortable in navigating this unknown landscape. How can you share just a little bit about what you, know, you
there's an interesting story behind that. Again, just serendipity. When I sold the book to Dutton, the first draft of the Damascus cover, none of that existed. The spy story was pretty much intact. And I went to New York and I met the editor, a guy by the name of Charlie Sopkin, no longer with us. And he handed me a book called Harry's Game by a British writer, an Irish writer named Gerald Seymour. He said to me, this is a book about Northern Ireland, novel, thriller. And he says, when you read it, you smell Northern Ireland. You taste it. You feel it. You see it. I want you to go back and do that with Damascus. I said, cool. Sounds like it would be a good thing to do. And all my novels since then I've done that with. They're all marked by this kind of very detailed description. It's a little easier now. When I wrote the Damascus cover, it was before the internet. So I found this book called Mirror to Damascus by a British traveler. And he went everywhere in Damascus, so I stole whatever I could steal from him. Today, pretty much anything you need is in Google Images. Mm-hmm. Even to, I have a checkpoint, the Jabar checkpoint, between Jordan and Syria. And I wanted to describe it. So I'm there Googling and pictures pop up of this, you know, small, insignificant checkpoint in the Syrian desert. So I was able to copy my description from what I'd seen. So again, you know, there's your life takes unusual turns. Usually small things happen. You go one way, you know, you meet your spouse. If you didn't go to that party, maybe you wouldn't have met them. And this one particular editor who bought the Damascus cover taught me, he didn't teach me how to do it. He taught me to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, he said, you need to do this. And I thought, wow, that would be fun.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I've done it all the way through in all the books.
Well, it's a terrific read. We're going to hold it up to the camera again. And I am going to encourage everybody, you need to know what's going on, where the roots of what's happening today are in this book, The Syrian Sunset. Howard, what are you working on next? And how can people find you?
I've been, you know, how can I say this? I've been writing my whole life and I've produced 6 novels. You know, there are a lot of people who write a novel every year. I'm not slow. I wish I could say that I'm working on them for 5 or 10 years and they're so perfect. I have trouble finding ideas that really drive me. I don't want to write something that's not that interesting just to get a book out and try to get sales and keep a fan base.
Yeah.
So I've been working on now, most recently, the screenplay for The Syrian Sunset, because I hired there's a screenwriter working on it. And he's done an admirable job, but it needed a lot of work and a lot of editing, which I can provide. For example, Shy, I've written 4 books with him. You know, I know how he acts and what he does and when he's not exactly right. So I literally finished editing it today, this morning. I have a couple of things I want to go over tomorrow. And then I've got no more excuses. So I'm going to have to come up with something new. So maybe you've inspired me with this idea to continue on Syria. I'm not sure yet, but
yeah.
I'm going hiking into Mescal Canyon and Pacific Palisades Saturday with a group. So maybe in that sweet environment, I'll think a little bit.
Where can people find you?
I have a Twitter account, but I don't use it. I find Twitter a wasteland. I do use Instagram, where I'm Kaplan Howe, the way my name is spelled. And I particularly answer Facebook, my regular profile. I have an author profile, but I end up answering my regular profile daily. Sure. People, if you write there and you just say, I heard you on the radio, so I know you're not a crypto scammer, I'll be happy to answer.
Jim has a couple of quotes. Honey, you want to share?
We need to move through this quickly. This is from the famous Lebanese philosopher and writer, Khalil Gibran. I think I got somewhere close to that. Love one another, but make not a bond of love. Let it rather be a moving sea between the shores of your soul. And that kind of ties into our character here, Margaret Edo. She's a long time on again, famous, a divine force on the planet.
Yeah, it's really a remarkable thing when I learned that.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Imagine Howard, everywhere you go, it starts that way.
Amazing. Yeah. Howard, thank you so much for being with us tonight. We want to say a thank you to Sam Hassan of LA Talk Radio and Blue Cottage Agency and all of us.